the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Many of you know already that we're in the middle of a series. We're in week three of a series looking at 1 John, under the title Dear Friends, Love from John. And we're week three, Dear Friends, Love One Another. And for those who have missed out maybe and don't know where we're at in this, at the series, let me just give you a quick running commentary of why John wrote his letter. He wrote it to a small church in the first century, a church that was under pressure, a church that perhaps felt spiritual pressure, emotional pressure, maybe even physical pressure. It was a church that had grown up and had converted mainly from perhaps Greek population and a Roman population. It was coming out of that background, and it was surrounded, therefore, by Greek and Roman culture, which was quite alien to it in many ways. But not just that. It seems to be that within the church there'd been some problems, and that a certain number of people had left the church or in the process of leaving the church because of teachings that had come which weren't based on the traditions that people had converted through to be followers of Jesus, but were adding extra things. So here's a young church that is being finding itself sort of threatened or pressurized. And into that situation, John writes this letter. He writes it to encourage them, to help remain faithful, and also to help to hang on to those things he had heard in the past. The first half of the letter we've been through already, and that first part of the letter talks about God is light. And John is encouraging that small, fragile church to remain in the light, to stay in the light, and not to go into darkness. And there's lots of sort of picture language in those first couple of chapters. So here we're in chapter 3. And what we're going to do in chapter 3 is explore a second dimension that John brings in his letter. This second dimension that God is love. And he challenges the children of God to remain in love and actually to love each other despite those pressures that they're facing, despite the ups and downs of life. And as we've heard earlier, and as I'm sure it's true in all your own lives, it's true in my life, that we all face the ups and downs of life. Even within the Christian community, there are pressures that we feel and circumstances and situations where we feel under pressure, perhaps spiritual pressure, perhaps emotional pressure, perhaps even physical pressure at times. So I think this is a great letter to explore, I think, and to give us encouragement. And I hope it is an encouragement as much as a challenge tonight. Now, I'm sure, along with me, I very rarely get down to the shops. I'm not that sort of person. I'd much rather sit in a cafe while my family goes shopping. But even I have seen the number of sort of red things and heart-shaped things and stuff in the shops. And for all those men out there, that's a subtle hint. You've got a couple of days to buy something. And so have I, actually. But I was doing a little troll on what's out there to buy. So I found some really interesting, so last-minute bargains here. That loving couple could buy gloves where you can still hold hands in the cold weather. You can get a heart-shaped pepperoni pizza. Actually, my favourite one, I think, is the fried egg, to be honest. I quite fancy that one. Darling, did you notice I like that one? That's right. Okay. I know a lot of people buy cards or give a gift, and it's seen as a way of demonstrating your love for someone else. Your passion is involved in taking action, in doing things for other people. So tonight I wonder, if I can get this to work. There we go. Are you a passionate lover? That's what I want to focus on today. Are you a passionate lover? I want this to be an encouragement, because I think actually this church is full of passionate lovers, this community. I'm not talking about that intimate, that exclusive love of the couple, that these days is what Valentine's all about. I'm thinking more of the communal love that actually Saint Valentine died for, that very early Christian martyr, where he died because he went against what the law, what the Romans were arguing for, that had banned marriage, and he carried on marrying Christians, and for that he was martyred. So we're not thinking of Valentine's Day as that exclusive one-to-one. But what we're thinking of Valentine's is about that self-sacrifice for other people. Sacrificing things, your time, your energies perhaps, for the benefit of other people. And we're going to look at it through three titles tonight. Why should we love? How should we love? And how passionate are we at Belmont? That last sort of application really looking through. So let's start tonight. We're going to read 1 John 2, 28 through, and we're going to read the first half of 1 John 3. So on page 1159 of the Church Bibles, if you're using one of those. And now, dear children, continue in him so that when he appears, we may be confident and unashamed before him at his coming. If you know that he is righteous, you know that everyone who does what is right has been born of him. See what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God. And that is what we are. The reason the world does not know us is that it did not know him. Dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known. But we know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. All who have this hope in him purify themselves just as he is pure. Everyone who sins breaks the law. In fact, sin is lawlessness. But you know that he appeared so that he might take away our sins, and in him is no sin. No one who lives in him keeps on sinning. No one who continues to sin has either seen him or known him. Dear children, do not let anyone lead you astray. The one who does what is right is righteous, just as he is righteous. The one who does what is sinful is of the devil, because the devil has been sinning from the beginning. The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work. Those who are born of God will not continue to sin, because God's seed remains in them. They cannot go on sinning, because they have been born of God. This is how we know who the children of God are and who the children of the devil are. Those who do not do what is right are not God's children, nor are those who do not love their brothers and sisters. So we'll pause there and we'll explore that little part of the passage. Now, in a sense, I'm not going to go through this passage tonight verse by verse. We're going to look at the big picture so we've got time to reflect and to apply it to our own lives. Now, I'm a secondary school teacher. And one of the things I've just been through, apart from being on half term, of course, hooray, is parents' evenings always come before half terms or holidays. So I've just been through two nights, a night and an afternoon of parents' evening, and I really like parents' evenings. I like parents' evenings because in secondary school, you rarely have a chance to meet parents. And I love meeting parents because it helps me understand my students more. Sometimes to wind up my students, I often say, I like to meet your parents because then I can work out who to feel sorry for. But why I really like to meet parents is because my students carry the DNA of their parents, all jumbled up and mixed up. Their biological parents, if you like, have passed something on. The children imitate physically aspects. You look at them and you think, oh, you look such a spitting image of your father. The daughters hate me saying that. But it's not just that. It's not just the biological significance. It's also, I notice the students have the mannerisms, sometimes use the language of sort of the sociological side, the way they've been brought up. So they have the DNA of their parents, but they also have, if you like, the sort of the dynamics, their behavior is influenced by their social parents. And it's this imitation, I think, of parents and of older siblings, perhaps even, that's central to this passage in 1 John. So this is what John's saying right at the beginning of chapter 3. See what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God. And that is what we are. In a way, by calling Jesus' followers children of God, John is encouraging them, encouraging them to reflect the character of God, the values, the behavior. God has become maybe not the biological father, but definitely the sociological father of the people of God. He's their adopted father. He's the father that they should spend time with, they should listen to, they should talk to. They've become part of a bigger family. And so in a sense, if you're a follower of Jesus here, if you're a child of God, then you're called to imitate that father. So the question, of course, is what behavior should we reflect? And helpfully, John, at the end of that passage we wrote, says this: anyone who does not do what is right is not God's child, nor is anyone who does not love their brother and sister. So a child of God should live a right life of love, or to phrase it better, a righteous life of love. John in chapter 3, he's contrasting somebody who's living in the light and somebody who's living in the darkness. He's talking about somebody who's loving and somebody who's not loving. In fact, there's a whole range of contrasts. It's part of the way he structured his letter. So the children of God are pure, the children of the devil are impure. The children of God are lawful, the children of the devil are lawless. Righteousness versus sinfulness. Love versus hate, later on in the chapter we're going to read in a little while. Life rather than death. John encourages this small community under pressure to live a pure, lawful, righteous life of love. But again, I suppose we have to ask ourselves, what is a righteous life of love? We know that we're children of God. We know we're meant to live a righteous life of God, of love. So now perhaps we need to unpack the next level and say, what does that righteousness look like? How do we live out day by day as a Christian community? This is written for a church community. It's about relationships within the church. So we're not talking here about how Christians should relate to non-Christians outside of the church. There's plenty of passages about that in the Bible. But this is about how should Christians relate to each other in formal settings like this, maybe less formal settings like home group, and maybe even informal settings, maybe for meals or you're out and about with each other and things like that. What does a righteous life look like? That's what we're going to focus on. Righteousness is linked to law. It's linked to following the law. So, nice and easy, what's the law? For Jews of the first century, the law, you could start with the Ten Commandments and then move on to the whole of the Torah, particularly the first five books of what we call the Old Testament. But for Jesus, interestingly, I think this is really important, Jesus does something in his ministry. As you read the Gospels, you'll see that Jesus actually goes beyond the Torah. He goes beyond the Ten Commandments. Jesus reinterprets the law. So whenever we see in the New Testament writers writing about the law or talking about the law, we have to think about what's the law they're talking about, the Jesus reinterpretation of the law, perhaps. So here, a famous passage in Matthew 22, where Matthew records, what does Jesus say about the law? In this passage, somebody's asking Jesus a trick question. What's the most important commandment out of the Ten Commandments? That's a trick, because clearly if he chose one, then he's under pressure because everybody would say, well, what's wrong with the other nine? It's a no-win situation. So Jesus typically subverts the question and does his own thing. So as we read it, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. So in one sense, Jesus is expanding the law here. He's not saying is this law or that law. He puts all the law together, into a new packaging. He expands the law. And this is repeated not just, say, in the Gospels here, but if we look in Paul's writing. So here I've got something, a nice summary from Galatians, but in Romans you'll see this as well. For the entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command: love your neighbor as yourself. And John, later on, as we'll read, says this actually in this chapter. And this is his command: to believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and to love one another as he commanded us. So interestingly, If we're disciples of Jesus, if we're adopted children of God, if we're called to be lovers, to love one another, then we're called to follow the law of love. So a righteous life is a life of love. Now, in the time I've got tonight, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the passages, verses 4 through to 9. For some Christians, it's quite of a struggle passage, actually. We could spend our whole evening just talking about that. It talks about the fact that Christians shouldn't sin. I think, I'm just going to say something very quickly about it. You can talk to me afterwards about it. Simply to believe that is a total wrong interpretation of that passage. John, earlier on in the passage, talks about when Christians sin. So he clearly knows that Christians sin. Paul talks about his own sin. This passage is not about sinless perfection. In fact, the Greek is about present continuous. This is somebody who habitually sins, who keeps on sinning, whose sinning is part of their image. It's not the person who is sorrowful for their sin, but somebody who is embracing sin and is not changing their behavior patterns to follow it. It's much following a Greek understanding of sin, which is the virtues, the habits of life, character. And so I haven't got time to unpack that, but if anybody wants to wrestle with that, I'm very happy to talk to them afterwards. But I want to move on. Having established that we're called as children of God to live passionate lives of love, to be righteous law followers of love, then I suppose we need to ask ourselves, how should we love? So let's read the second half of 1 John 3. For this is the message. So I'm reading from verse 11. It's still on 1:159. For this is the message you heard from the beginning. We should love one another. Do not be like Cain, who belonged to the evil one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his own actions were evil and his brothers were righteous. Do not be surprised, my brothers and sisters, if the world hates you. We know that we have passed from death to life because we love each other. Anyone who does not love remains in death. Anyone who hates a fellow believer is a murderer, and you know that no murderers have eternal life in them. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for one another. If any one of you has material possessions and sees his brother or sister in need, but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in you? Dear children, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth. This is how we know that we belong to the truth and how we set our hearts at rest in his presence. If our hearts condemn us, we know that God is greater than our hearts, and he knows everything. Dear friends, if our hearts do not condemn us, we have confidence before God and receive from him anything we ask, because we keep his commands and do what pleases him. And this is his command, to believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and to love one another as he commanded us. Those who keep his commands live in him, and he in them. And this is how we know that he lives in us. We know it by the Spirit he gave us. So verse 11 onwards contrasts the life of love and the life of hate. Cain is an example of a life of hate, a child of Satan rather than a child of God. And John helpfully adds more detail to illustrate what a righteous, passionate life of love should look like. So there we go. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ becomes our role model. As adopted children of God, the biological Son of God, who's older than us, who's closer to the Father, to use that sort of picture language, becomes our role model that we imitate. It's quite interesting for those who have children that sometimes the younger child often imitates the older child in family life or looks for approval from the older child. Sometimes they're rowing and stuff, but at other times there is that sort of role modeling from the older, wiser child and things. And so as Christians, we have Christ as our role model. And here, what John is reminding them is of Jesus's the passion, the passionate Christ, the death, the sacrifice, the behavior for other people. So as adopted children, we can imitate the biological son, who demonstrates real passionate love, commitment, and sacrifice. John reminds the children of God to imitate him, as we see in this. And we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. So again, this is just a message to a small church in a fragile situation. It's focusing on how should they behave with each other going through this crisis. We may not be going through the dramatic crisis they're going through, but we can pull a message of hope and a message of love out of these passages. That's central to the core teaching of how the church should be is a community of love. And so we're looking at, are you a passionate lover? John is reminding the church that love is not self-seeking. Love is not deliberately putting yourself first. Some philosophers talk about egocentric love, love that focuses on the self. Then there's talk of mutualistic love. So when I teach sexual ethics, we talk about how all of these things sort of work out. So mutualistic love will be friends with benefits. But it's not sacrificial love. It's not agapeic love, as some people talk about it. The love of the other person, putting the other person, acting so others benefit. John also goes on to say that love is not an emotion, something else our Valentine's Day modern world talks about. Not only do we live in a world that's very individualistic, it's about my love and very exclusive love, them and me. But also, we're talking about the idea that love, is love an emotion or not? In the ancient world, love wasn't an emotion, it was an act of the will. And so again, here in 1 John 3:18, he goes on to say, dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions. Love is not a noun. Love is a verb. You can't say I love someone without actually doing something about it. You may claim you love someone, but we can claim all sorts of things. As I say to my students at school when I'm teaching philosophy, I can believe in all sorts of things. I can believe the moon is made out of cheese. It doesn't make it true. And if you claim to love someone, then that's a load of hocus pocus unless it's acted out in encounter, in relationship. And verse 17, just before this, is an example of that community in the situation and circumstances they were facing of how they worked out love. So if anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need, but has no pity, has no love on them, then how can the love of God be in that person? If we've encountered God, then we should be transformed. The habits that we have, going back to the first half of the passage, should be changed. We have old habits. We should be taking on more and more new habits. It's not going to be instant for many people. We're going to wrestle with our old life and our new life. But in this Valentine's week, I think 1 John really reminds us to love each other. To love each other as a community of God's people here in Exeter with actions, not for our own benefit, not for our own gain, but for the benefit of others. Popular culture often believes that you can get to heaven by being good. But loving behavior isn't a means of getting into heaven. Loving behavior is the consequence and a response to knowing that you're going to heaven. God has acted. Jesus has died for us. Our response is love. So perhaps we need to move on and talk about how passionate are you? How passionate am I? How passionate are we as a church? I wonder what examples you can think of when you think of passionate people. I've got a couple of examples up here. Football supporters, I think, are pretty passionate people. Well, depends which football team you support, I suppose. But I have a friend of mine, I've mentioned this probably a while back. I have a friend who's definitely a passionate Reading supporter. You've got to be pretty passionate to support Reading, of course. And he goes to all home matches. You can't get to the away matches. He actually plays the drum. He's part of the drummers at the Reading match, and he plays the drum to help with the team and things like that. And he wears the scarf and the hat, and he's got the coat with the logo on, and he's got the sweatshirt with the logo on, and he has got slippers with the logo on. Seriously. And clearly, he is passionate about Reading. And again, here's just one protest movement. But again, protesters, political or issue-based protesters, are passionate people. Passion means the willingness to commit time, energy, space, money to something. To invest in something. And so again, if we're passionate people, if we're called to be passionate people, then we're called to be committed people. We're called to focus on something, to make it a priority in your life. You don't have to be loud. You don't have to be upfront. You don't have to be an extrovert to be passionate. You don't have to be in people's faces to be passionate. Passion isn't a social expression. It's an attitude, it's a virtue, it's a habit that we have. It's an orientation, if you like, to things. So Jesus tells us to be lovers of each other. He tells us to show commitment to each other, to make others a priority in our lives. So I wonder, have a think back over the last couple of weeks, if you're a regular attender here, and if you're not, just think about who's been passionate in your life over the last few weeks. Who's put you first? Where have you encountered scenarios, situations where somebody has given up something for your benefit? We'll all have different examples, perhaps. Some of them we might not even register. Some examples we could say are very general. You know, many of us were served tea and coffee before the service, but those people had to get here early. They had to sort everything out. They had to tidy up, wash up afterwards. There's actually an example of very general, sacrificial, passionate love. Those who come and clean the church, change the toilet rolls, wash the floor. Very practical, down to earth, not in your face, passionate love, but with people who are willing to serve others. There may be some examples very specific to you in your own family circumstances and situations. I wonder how you felt when you received that love, whether explicit love direct to you or whether more of a general love. I hope you felt valued. I hope you felt special. Because you are. Because John tells the church that we should show love to each other every day. Why? Because God loves us. As it rolls out, God is love. He calls us to love in reflection of his love, his character. Because of circumstances, some of us are able to be passionate lovers more than others in different times and in different places, exercising different gifts. But we should always be seeking opportunities to act in love to each other. That's what John's saying to this church. How passionate are you? How passionate are we? How passionate are each of us? I want to thank you for being passionate. Because actually, there's a huge amount of passion that goes on in Belmont Church. Belmont should be known for being a passionate, loving church. We're full of passionate lovers. Because so many of you, in all different ways, some very public, some very private, love each other in all sorts of different ways. And I think sometimes as a church, not just this church, but as a church in general, we often are very good at telling you what to do and make you feel a little bit bad about yourself. But I want you to go away tonight feeling very positive about yourself. Because not only does God love you, which is pretty fantastic anyway, but actually, through their actions, loads of people love you and think you're valuable enough to give up time and energy and money, etc., etc. God is love, and his people are called to love as well. So thank you. If you have a look in the focus, you'll see all the different groups down the side here every week that run. They're run by volunteers, people who are passionate lovers. I'm going to give a couple of suggestions. If you want to be even more passionate in your loving, we'll come and have a look at that. I've got two suggestions to increase your passion. When Ali and I came to Belmont Church 8 years ago, we came two Sundays. We'd just moved down from London. So we came two Sundays running. We thought we'd suss you out, see if you're the sort of place we could fit into. Nobody talked to us. Two Sundays running. So we went elsewhere. And 5 years later, we came back. But it's a challenge. It's difficult because it's such a big church. You know, I recognize lots of faces. I'm rubbish with names. And I'm an introvert, so I'm not very good at talking to people. So if I have my stock phrase, I always have. I always say, have you been coming to the church long? That's my sort of standard opening sentence. Because I don't really like talking to people about sort of things like that. I'd much rather sit in a library with lots of heavy books and think about big theologians and stuff. But I know that if I'm going to be part of you as a community, then I need to actively step out of my comfort zone and actually get involved. And each of us sometimes has to step out of our comfort zone. It's so much easier to chat to friends that we know on a Sunday. And it's good to chat to them because we may not have seen them for a whole week. But my challenge for you is maybe actually go up to people you don't know. It's also easier to get on with people that you agree with. And so again, you may know somebody who you just don't agree on something, maybe politically, because that's what sort of an area we're talking about. But that's no grounds for not being in fellowship with them. You can accept people without agreeing with them. And I think that's really important in a large church. You're going to get diversity of views as well. And then the second one is thank you. I don't know how often people write notes or emails or cards. I've got a new head in my school, and he's very good at dropping a little postcard into my pigeonhole, which is saying, thank you for doing this. Thank you. And it's something that just sort of makes you swell up a little bit, that somebody's taken the effort to write a card and give it. There are so many unsung, passionate lovers in this church, and it'd be really good if we could encourage each other. I was at a church. I used to be sort of an assistant, I suppose, to a minister before I went and studied theology. I spent a year being a PA, really, to one of my ministers. And I filed all his letters. And I have to say, none of them were positive. It was really sad. In fact, I was advised, I'm well over time now, I was advised that if I went into pastoral ministry, to keep a folder of positive letters I would receive in ministry, because when times were tough, I could go back and read them. Because you would get this number of negative letters and this number of positive letters. It's very easy to critique. It seems within the British psyche, maybe, it's much harder to praise. So a challenge to us, over tea and coffee, and maybe to write thank you notes. I think that's really, really important. Then what I've done is, I asked Clive earlier this week, are there any other areas of service in Belmont that perhaps we could look at? And I know that's quite big up on that one, it's small on my screen. So here's just a range of areas, again, that are very easy for you to think about. How much time have you got? How much energy have you got? What's your personality like? How much money you've got? Whatever. In terms of, are any of these areas, because they're all in need of extra support. It may be that this isn't the time or the place for you to be able to contribute more or to start contributing because of life circumstances. Or it may be that you can step up at this time, at this place, that you've got an opportunity, you've got a window maybe in your life at this moment to be more passionate. And again, all of that sort of information through the church office, you can find out about the opportunities to serve. There's one opportunity, and that I'm just going to end with, really, is this one. This is a slightly different one. Brian Sperling, who's based at this church, also is the Southwest, I don't know what his official title is, Director of Urban Saints. And every summer, we run a camp. Belmont take a group of young people, 8 to 12-year-olds, to Spree. Last year, there was something like 1,200 people in a field over near Crediton. About 1,000 8 to 12-year-olds. And there's Christian activities, there's teaching, there's worship, there's all sorts of crafts and things. And he's looking this year, they're doing things slightly different, and they're looking for volunteers to man stands like some of the inflatable toys and things like that. So not to stand up on the stage and to do big stuff like that, but to serve behind the scenes, to do low-grade things. It may, again, not be appropriate for you because of your family, your circumstances, etc., etc. But again, I throw it out there as an opportunity. One weekend, I don't know if you have to go the whole weekend or whether it can just be a partial weekend, but again, to serve the wider Christian family. So dear friends, love one another. Why should we love? We should imitate our Father in heaven and our older brother Jesus. How to love? Let us love not with words or speech, but with actions and truth. How passionate are we? I think there's lots to be encouraged about. But let us continue ways, whether publicly, privately, whether big, whether small, to love each other more and more. And so we reflect God's love to each other. And perhaps we're not a small community in a fragile situation, suffering hurt as a community, as John's community was to whom he wrote in the first century. But down through history, once again, we're called to be the same community of love. Let us pray together. May this Valentine's week remind us to serve each other day by day, O Lord. Help us, Father, to see the opportunities around us to serve. Help us to know the gifts and talents that we have received from you so that we can use them to serve others. Give us the courage to step out of our comfort zone to love each other. And help us to have the humility to accept the love of others. Amen.